Ukraine's president claims more territory is recaptured from Russia.
Сьогодні продовжився наступальний рух нашої армії. Усіх наших захисників є нові.
Plus, Russian lawmakers move forward with their illegal annexation of Ukrainian land.
Нас тепер 89 суб'єктів. Ми ждем от нових територій сенаторів, з которыми ми будемо активно і дружно работать.
And later in the program, how President Joe Biden is likely to react to President Vladimir Putin's threat to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine. Today is Tuesday, October 4th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Herman, in for Steve Miller. Ukraine is continuing to make progress reclaiming territory. That's the latest from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In his nightly address to the nation, he said there are new liberated settlements in several regions, but that fierce fighting continues in many areas of the front. The Ukrainian president also said there is a growing understanding that Russia made a mistake by starting a war against Ukraine. Zelensky added there are many fanatics who will never admit the obvious, that this is a pointless war for Russia, that Russia cannot win. The latest on the battlefront developments from Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv.
Ukrainian armed forces continue their advance in the Kharkiv, Donetsk and Kherson regions. According to the Ukrainian General Staff, over the past days, Ukrainian forces managed to liberate a very strategic city of Lyman and the area around it in the Donetsk region, which enables the Ukrainian army to get more favorable positions in the Donbas front line. Ukrainian forces are now moving forward towards the Luhansk region border. In the latest reports, Ukrainian officials confirm the liberation of the number of settlements from two opposite sides of the city of Kherson. This area remains very tough for Ukrainian forces to advance in due to the landscape and concentration of the Russian forces. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Kyiv.
In the upper house of the Russian parliament on Tuesday, a self-congratulatory round of applause.
Решение принято.
Valentina Matviyenko, chairwoman of the Federation Council, announcing ratification of four new subjects of the Russian Federation following a similar rubber stamp vote Monday in the lower house, the Duma. The chairwoman says the documents now return to the Kremlin for President Putin's signature. Russia declared the annexations after holding what it called referendums in occupied areas of Ukraine. Western governments in Ukraine say the votes breached international law, were coercive, and non-representative. Western intelligence agencies this week are keeping watch for any signs Russia might be preparing to use tactical nuclear weapons against Ukraine. This comes following reiterated threats last week from Russian President Vladimir Putin. After illegally annexing four regions of Ukraine, he warned of the use of all means available if the territorial integrity of Russia is threatened. Then on Friday, Putin commented that the atomic bombings of two Japanese cities by the United States at the end of World War II had created the precedent for the use of nuclear weapons. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine is Daryl Kimball, the executive director of the Arms Control Association. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Daryl, you take the position that there is no viable nuclear option for Russia in Ukraine. Can you explain what you mean by that?
These thinly veiled threats from Vladimir Putin about nuclear weapons use, not just to defend Russia or to defend Russian forces in Ukraine from NATO or U.S. attack, but against Ukrainian forces in Ukrainian territory, are very serious. They're unprecedented in the post-Cold War age. As I've written in Arms Control Today, if one looks at the implications of the use of lower-yield so-called tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, even by Vladimir Putin's cold, hard-hearted logic, it does not make sense for Russia, for Putin, and for their interests. And of course, it would change the face of this conflict. It would create destruction on a scale that we've not yet seen in Ukraine and not seen, quite frankly, in decades.
U.S. President Joe Biden has said recently that if Moscow deploys nuclear or chemical weapons, it'll, quote, change the face of war unlike anything since World War II, unquote. And there would be consequences. What are the likely consequences?
Well, the first consequences would be, as President Biden suggested, severe destruction in Ukraine. First of all, we should remember that tactical nuclear weapons aren't just, you know, bigger thermobaric bombs or more powerful conventional weapons. Russia has about 450 air-delivered and ground-delivered short-range tactical nuclear weapons. Many, if not most, of these warheads are in the 10 kilotons of TNT yield range. And to put that in perspective, the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima on August 6, 1945 was about 15 kilotons TNT. So these are enormously destructive. They don't just produce a blast. They produce intense heat and radiation effects. That's what President Biden's referring to when he's talking about destructive potential not seen since World War II. Now, how the United States might respond, I think President Biden said it best in his 60 Minutes interview a couple of weeks ago. Depending on what Vladimir Putin might actually do, then the United States will respond accordingly. There are many different variations and permutations for the use of a smaller number or larger number of tactical nuclear weapons in and around Ukraine by Russia. In no circumstance, in my view, would U.S. nuclear retaliation be warranted if Russia uses tactical nuclear weapons. That would invite escalation to the global level. And most of the war games that have been conducted by the U.S. military in the past few years involving fighting between NATO and Russian forces wind up with global thermonuclear war. So that's what we want to avoid. The United States has enormous, along with NATO, enormous conventional strike potential. You know, one option that the United States and NATO might consider would be to strike with conventional weapons against the installations that launch the tactical nuclear weapons attacks. I think there could also be a very strong diplomatic response, sidestepping the UN Security Council, which of course Russia has a veto at. The UN General Assembly could act to punish Russia by means of a rarely used provision called Uniting for Peace Resolution, which was actually invoked to authorize the use of force to repel North Korean forces in the Korean conflict. That's the kind of unprecedented diplomatic measures that might be pursued. I think the other thing that would happen, and this is another reason why Putin may recognize that tactical nuclear weapons use doesn't make sense, it would destroy any semblance of support that Putin has from President Xi Jinping, from Prime Minister Modi. His internal support might also collapse. There's already enormous dissension within Russia right now because of the partial mobilization.
Daryl, you have been publicly calling for responsible leaders to reinforce the nuclear weapons taboo now. But do you believe that there is any preemptive rhetoric from such leaders that can influence Putin?
Well, I'm not sure if anything at this stage can really influence Putin in a radically different way. He's clearly determined to try to, you know, win this war in some way or another, or to avoid defeat. So he's taking greater risk now with his partial mobilization. But I think we need to look at all the tools in our toolkit. And one of the tools that has not been fully employed is to rally the world right now against Putin's nuclear threats through public and private messages to him, to his foreign minister, to his defense minister about what the terrible consequences would be, economic, political, military, if he were to take this momentous step.
Daryl Kimball, who runs the Arms Control Association here in Washington. Thank you for your insight today on Flashpoint Ukraine.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. UN Human Rights Monitors report freedom of expression, assembly, and other civil and political rights are tightly constrained in Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine, including Crimea. A new report on conditions in Ukraine by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since its last update in July, UN monitors report a dramatic escalation in the war in Ukraine. They document continued widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure. They report Russian attacks against civilians in populated areas using explosive weapons have caused many casualties. Russia has denied targeting civilians. UN monitors say reports of torture and ill treatment of enforced disappearance of both civilians and prisoners of war continue. They add some of those and other human rights violations could amount to war crimes. The report finds civilians continue to bear the brunt of hostilities. It has documented 6,114 civilians killed and more than 9,000 injured. However, it notes the real figures are likely to be considerably higher. Christian Salazar-Folkman is Director of Field Operations and Technical Cooperation Division. He says UN monitors report the rights to freedom of opinion, expression, and peaceful assembly have been restricted in territory occupied by the Russian Federation or controlled by Russian armed forces and affiliated armed groups.
Ukrainian television channels and radio stations have been disconnected and replaced with channels from the Russian Federation or self-proclaimed republics. In Crimea, the Russian Federation has applied legislation penalizing a wide spectrum of expression deemed critical, and teachers have been pressured to endorse the armed attack.
He says he's concerned that this highly restrictive environment is deterring people from reporting the human rights violations they have witnessed.
While the purported annexation of the Ukrainian regions of Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia further to the so-called referenda, the Russian Federation has taken steps which deepen rather than resolve the conflict and exacerbate the human rights violations associated with it, moving further away from peace towards escalation.
He notes any annexation of a state's territory by another state is a violation of the principle of the UN Charter and international law. Ukrainian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Yevhenia Filipenko, says the Kremlin's plan to conquer Ukraine continues to fail, prompting Russia to threaten the use of nuclear weapons. That, she says, is leaving people around the world in a state of fear and insecurity. Despite all the threats, she says Ukraine will not stop fighting until all territories are liberated and Russia is held accountable for its crimes. First Secretary of Russia's permanent mission to the UN in Geneva, Guzal Kusanova, calls the report one-sided and unbalanced. She accuses the Office of the High Commissioner of lacking the courage to report on war crimes allegedly committed by the Ukrainians. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It remains an international mystery. Who is responsible for the apparent sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines, and why did they do it? Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak has been saying that it is technically possible to restore the ruptured offshore infrastructure, but that will require time and appropriate funds. Kremlin officials deny Moscow was behind the four leaks. President Putin blames the United States and its allies. Christine Berzna is a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund and former head of the geopolitics team at the Alliance for Securing Democracy. Among her specializations is energy security. Christine, welcome to Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thank you for having me.
Still a lot of finger-pointing going on from the Baltic states in Moscow and here in Washington. I know we're lacking some concrete facts. What makes the most sense to you on a culprit and motive?
You're right that we don't have a full set of facts, and investigations are ongoing. But it's really important to look at two factors when thinking about the whodunit with blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines. The first one is, who has the ability to blow up the pipeline? And the second one is, who has the motivation to do so? These are undersea pipelines that are not at oceanic depths, but they are not very easily accessible. The pipelines where the explosions took place are not right next to each other. Both the Nord Stream 1 explosions and the Nord Stream 2 explosions occurred in the Baltic Sea, but at a significant distance from each other. Whoever blew up the pipelines would have had to find them and have the ability to travel between those locations or have two different teams present to create the two explosions. So you need intelligence and awareness of where these things are. You need an ability to get deep underwater. And you also need to have been able to do it quickly in two different locations. This suggests a level of sophistication of intelligence and capabilities that many countries do not have. The country that has a significant amount of intelligence on the location of the pipelines is Russia, because, of course, they are Russian pipelines, at least partially. The ability to do sophisticated attacks under the sea is something else that Russia has a lot of capabilities in. Russia has also both manned and unmanned submarine vessels. So looking at that ability, Russia is a big culprit. Other big navies, maybe.
But at first glance, it's essentially self-sabotage because Russia, it seems, has a great vested interest in the continued operation of this pipeline or pipelines.
You're absolutely right. This does seem counterintuitive. After all, Russia was so insistent that these pipelines are necessary for Europe and for Russia. However, Russia has already made a decision not to use the pipeline, Nord Stream 1, for moving gas to Europe. Starting in September, this pipeline, Russia started reducing the amount of gas coming through these pipelines already last year, and then really stopped in September for politically motivated reasons. Russia does not want Europe to have this gas because Russia wants Europe to suffer. It is not an asset to Russia anymore in that state.
Yes, we're seeing the energy ramifications of the loss of the Nord Stream pipelines being waved off as far as the impact on Europe, especially Germany, for this upcoming winter. Do you really concur with that assessment?
Russia had decided not to have this be a viable pipeline this winter. There was no chance from Russia's side that it would be increasing and restoring deliveries through that pipeline. So for this winter in Germany, it was dead already. And once we get to further winters, there is a significant political push in Germany to diversify away from Russian sources and in the long term, not use Russian gas at all anymore. Given that long-term trajectory and the fact that this winter was already out, it wouldn't be much of a loss to Russia to not have it, because in the short term and in the long term, there was no future for this pipeline.
Let's look at the longer term ramifications in terms of the Western European critical energy supply and policies as a result of the war, and the warning, obviously, from the apparent sabotage of the pipelines, regardless of who did it. For instance, does this temper green goals of cutting coal? And does it give nuclear power a bit of a revival on the continent?
This gives every other source of energy a revival on the continent. It's not lessening the green transformation. It's accelerating every form of energy that doesn't come from Russia and is not Russian gas, which means that there is a dramatic acceleration of every possible green technology, from solar panels to wind power to, in particular, wood, which, of course, has air quality implications apart from its generally renewable nature. You have lots of wood chips and pellets being used for both domestic sort of individual household heating as well as municipal and district heating. We've seen a growth in this specifically because it is a quick alternative to using gas. Solar panels have been very significantly installed across Central and Eastern Europe this past year, where it had not had a very large market. It's not, in particular, Northeast Europe, especially sunny. And yet, for example, in Latvia, this year, more solar panels were installed than had been installed previously altogether. Coal and nuclear and traditional old technologies that perhaps were going to be phased out that are still incredibly important. So really, it is anything that will heat or create electricity is essential this winter.
It really harkens back many decades for the Europeans to World War II and post-war era, it seems like.
In many ways, it is a scramble for heat and electricity in a way that Europe hasn't seen for decades. And in certain cities, it's going to be a dirty winter. There is concern that the return of burning coal, the potential for in certain countries of burning garbage. Poland is concerned that the kind of coal-fired furnaces that many households have can be fed with household refuse, with trash, and that would dramatically reduce air quality. If you think back to immediately, you know, post-Cold War Central Europe, the blackness that coal heating caused is not a welcome memory. And yet we might be seeing a lot more of that this winter. And even in some cities, we're seeing concern that as people return to using these old stoves and furnaces they have in their homes, do they know how to use them? Have they been adequately cleaned and prepared? And will people, you know, potentially poison themselves or otherwise cause accidents by being forced to use the kind of infrastructure in their homes that they have not used for decades?
Some concerning environmental ramifications from Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the weeks and months ahead. Christine Berzna from the German Marshall Fund, thank you for your comments today on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thank you.
A resident of Arlington in the U.S. state of Virginia, Christia Sonevsky, says she has always felt a connection with Ukraine, where her roots are. She successfully advocated for a sister city agreement between Arlington and Ivano-Frankivsk in southwestern Ukraine, and the two cities forged a partnership 11 years ago. When Russia invaded Ukraine, Arlington was quick to offer help. Maxine Moskalkov has the story.
Shelled buildings, city streets covered in rubble, people living in basements and subway stations to stay safe. As she watches news about the war in Ukraine from her home in Arlington, Virginia, 81-year-old Hrishcha Savinitsky relives her experience as a young girl during World War II. During that war, Savinitsky's parents fled Ukraine as Russian troops invaded the country. Savinitsky herself was born in Poland, where her family took refuge in a displaced persons camp. Later, her family moved, first to Canada, then to the United States. Arlington, Virginia has been her home for over 3 decades now. Yet, she still feels a deep connection to Ukraine. And it was this feeling that led her to initiate a sister city agreement between Arlington and Ivano-Frankivsk in southwestern Ukraine.
When I was trying to find a partner for Arlington, there were certain parameters that I was looking for, one of which was the size of the city, 240,000 versus 220-something for Arlington, so comparable in size. Also, plus it's a beautiful part of the country. It's near the Carpathian Mountains, and so I related Carpathian Mountains to our Shenandoah Valley.
Savinitsky says it took years to convince the city's Arlington Sister City Association to back the plan, and in 2011, Arlington and Ivano-Frankivsk became sister cities. Now, the two cities' local governments and citizens' committees jointly organize and host cultural and educational events. Liza Hodskins, a sister city volunteer, has traveled to Ivano-Frankivsk several times and hosted Ukrainians in Arlington.
They've been all around Washington and, of course, Arlington, met with county board members and various other people and spent time in the schools with the kids. We've also had a program where we have brought some Ukrainian firemen over from, again, our town, Ivano-Frankivsk.
Since Russia invaded Ukraine, the Arlington Sister City Association has been working to support the people of Ivano-Frankivsk. Arlington members say they will continue to back residents of their sister city as they fight to protect their freedom and homeland. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
That's all for today's program. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Chief National Correspondent, Steve Herman. Have a good evening.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.